Epilogue, Girl on Fire, 2020. Henry Hill, the mobster turned FBI informer, helped convict 50 New York mafia figures back in the 1980s. Director Martin Scorsese told the tale in the film Goodfellas. In the movie's final scene, Hill steps out his front door to fetch the morning paper from the porch. A two-toned station wagon sits in the driveway. Henry Hill has survived, but only because he is no longer Henry Hill. "Today everything is different," he says. "There's no action. I have to wait around like everyone else. I'm an average nobody. I get to live the rest of my life as a schnook." Since November 2018, there have been unconfirmed sightings of Gobbo in the Melbourne CBD and in beachside Brighton. But by 2020, she has disappeared. Has she gone her own way, or is she enjoying the tailor-made police protection she always demanded? Where is she now? No one knows. Her destination seems certain, no matter where she heads. It's a sad place, where no one knows your name, and demons chatter when you walk down the street. Police protection or not, Gobbo will follow Henry Hill to Nowheresville. She is sentenced to be a schnook. Boasting more convictions from her informing than Henry Hill wasn't the prime ministerial role Gobbo yearned for as a student, but it suited her better. If she liked to draw attention to herself, it was always on her terms. As informer 3838, she was a somebody, a confidant to both villains and cops. And so what if she was a walking catastrophe? Gobbo put people in jail for decades, and they never had a clue. She hoodwinked both the criminals and the judges by betraying those who trusted her most. Gobbo was a person everyone knew of and no one knew. She stung the good, the bad, and the dastardly. She played life as though it were a game, and she were the grandmaster. Gobbo was, as one of her handlers admits, always two steps ahead. Her powers of persuasion topped those of any politician, even when she was playing to an audience of hotheads, speed freaks, and goons. She deceived Carl Williams, the bogan prince who killed over petty grudges. He sent his hitman to scare her in 2003. He wanted her blood, or at least her reputation, by 2006. Yet she kept going, despite the bullets in the mail and the firebombing of her car, despite her alleged choking by Horty Mockbell and her eviction by her legal peers. When her handlers warned her to slow down, Gobbo responded with more gifts of information, like a needy lover who fears rejection. Gobbo was a woman in a boy's world, where the female pioneers tended to favour muted tones and an air of entitlement, like the men. But she wasn't like any of the men or women of the bar. Gobbo incriminated her clients so that they were criminally charged. She accepted their money, but secretly worked for the police prosecution on the opposite side of the courtroom. Her clients were worse than alone in the face of the law. No defense lawyer anywhere has had so little care for the rule of law. No lawyer, except a Catholic girl with every advantage from Melbourne's exclusive Inner East. She maintained the control by masquerading as one person while conniving as another, and only she can explain why. Her choices were foreign to anyone who values sincerity, trust, and a good night's sleep. It was a solitary existence, layered with terrors. Gobbo always felt like she was alone. She staved off her fears of abandonment by creating chaos. She was a fugitive from the truth, and she couldn't stop running. She cast herself as a victim in a righteous cause. This self-anointed vulnerability became a pattern to rush at the flames of notoriety, then wonder why no one saved her from the heat. Into her vortex flowed men. Bad men, some in the uniforms of the local police force. She rooted enough of us, one of her handlers once told Dowsley. Her men spun her moral compass. She wielded unlikely power by making herself available to these men as both lawyer and secretary. Nothing was too much trouble. Yet she was not as she appeared. Gobbo made herself available in other ways too. Perceptions can be terribly unfair, but attitudes to Gobbo have been drawn over decades. The ethical blur of her double life spread to her fraternizing. Gobbo's numerous sexual encounters were hopelessly intertwined with her informing. She didn't seem to mind that people thought her behavior loose. She slept with cops and criminals, and everyone in her circles talked about it, often because her choices sounded more calculated than romantic. Call it, as a once close colleague has, sex, lies, and recording devices, to misquote a well-known arthouse movie. Sex matters to Gobbo's story, much as it counts in understanding Mata Hari, the alleged German spy who seduced men on both sides of the World War I battle lines. The Dutch dancer and the Melbourne barrister share several traits. Both acted as solitary women among swarms of men. Both knew how to please those men and to get what they wanted in return. Gobbo always liked to be talked about. For her, infamy was equated with relevance. The problem, as her psychologist said in 2016, was that infamy was bad for her mental health. Rumours of sexual intimacy in public places can be traced back to her school days and her encounters at Tunnel Nightclub. She herself fanned these tales, fellow students say. Her university housemate, Brian Wilson, set an unfortunate benchmark. He was the first bad man among the dozen she fell prey to, and only some of them were on the wrong side of the law. Sergeant Trevor Ashton first registered Gobbo in 1995. His subordinate, Tim Argyll, like Argyll's old mate Paul Dale, has admitted under oath to having sex with her. Argyll, in answering an awkward question about an episode of physical intimacy, sounded ashamed in the witness box. Both he and Dale emphasized that they slept with Gobbo only once, as if the fact of the encounter were a blot on their judgment. Such couplings were symptoms of the throwback culture of a police force yet to fully evolve in the early 2000s. Under the stewardship of Christine Nixon, Victoria Police came to emblazon inclusive ideals, such as gay rights, as well as conciliatory resolutions to violence. But chauvinist notions persisted. Nixon herself was derisively dubbed Big Kev after an overweight cleaning entrepreneur. Police work on the front lines leads to marriage breakdowns and drinking problems. It always will, even if emotional dysfunction is better understood now than it once was. Gobbo was later diagnosed with PTSD and major depressive disorders, the kinds of ailments that hardened police officers can suffer in their work. She thrived in their blokey cohort of denial, where physical acts could be recounted later to your mates, and feelings were otherwise suppressed. She was one of the boys, until she went home with one of the boys. People talked. Gobbo graduated from footy groupie to badge bunny to gangster's mole. Even as she informed on her criminal clients, she used sex as a weapon to gain their trust. Drug baron Rob Karam supposedly serenaded her with movie dates and dinners. She indulged Karam's overtures because she wanted to help jail him. She might have slept with the European. She might have slept with Tony Mockbell, even if she vocally disputes such claims. The truth in either case is almost beside the point. Gobbo was spotted at intimate dinners where the body language invited labels of canoodling with criminals. Her lifestyle lent itself to the possibility that she slept with crooks. If there was a pattern to Gobbo's romantic life, it was flings and one-nighters. The constant was the absence of a regular man on her arm. Gobbo wanted normal romances. At least she said she did. But the bad man spectre never faded. Years after her informing ended, while she embraced the ordinariness of kindergarten mums in the suburbs, Gobbo still visited drug trafficker Richard Barco in prison because he was apparently the father of one, if not two, of her children. In the language of Matahari's accusers, Gobbo was bathed in immorality as one of the man-eaters. She was the high-flying defence barrister, said to be caught in a stairway encounter with a police officer at the now-closed Celtic Club. "They didn't break stride," a stairway witness says. Again, the important thing is not whether it did or didn't happen. It's that people accepted it could have happened. This tale circulated at Crockett Chambers and may have had a bearing on her eviction from the chambers. When flowers were delivered to Gobbo's office at Crockett Chambers on her birthday, colleagues greeted the gift with squealing and lots of questions. Here's the sad part. Some fellow barristers assumed Gobbo sent the flowers to herself. Former crime commander Terry Purton never met Gobbo, but he was involved in many discussions about her role as a human source. He described general perceptions to the Royal Commission. "It was sort of common knowledge that she had sexual relationships with people in the legal fraternity, and there could have been some scuttlebutt that she sort of tried to drag members of the force into bed. That was my gut feeling at the time, the same as the gut feeling with Tony Mockbell giving her a $25,000 Rolex watch. There was always something. Nicola was always the topic of discussion." Yet Gobbo was both a predator and a victim. A police officer is said to have once dropped her off at hospital after rough sex, only to fret over coming days that Gobbo would lodge a criminal complaint about her injury. Like a cheater who comes to wonder if others are cheating them too, Gobbo never really trusted people. She seemed to cheat herself as well as her clients. She was smart and feisty, but her accumulated wisdom did not extend to protecting her reputation. She instead embraced a label that no lady wants. Her cheating separates her from her closest counterpart. "A harlot, yes. A traitress, never," Matahari said in her own defence. The Hodson tragedy obsesses Dowsley and Carlyon. In New York, in late 2019, for a long overdue rest, Dowsley attended a Billy Joel concert in Madison Square Garden. His personal take on "She's Always a Woman" differed from that of every other fan that night, as Joel sang about secrets, lies, and killer smiles. When Dowsley met with Gobbo after his first Lawyer X stories were published in 2014, she sounded genuine when discussing the Hodson killings, stating that she wore the wire for the Hodson children. "Wouldn't you want me to do it if it was your parents?" If it's hard to believe her claim that her informing was motivated from the beginning by altruism or guilt, the notion of belated contrition might soften the easy view of Gobbo as a ruthless manipulator. There is one other major mitigating factor. Gobbo's choices were bathed in Shakespearean tragedy, in the timeless themes of ambition and greed. But she was abetted. She was a one-stop shop, but no one-woman show. Gobbo was manipulated by Victoria Police. Informer inducement is a niche of policing tethered to protocols, but in this case, they ought to have known better. And many close observers think they did. As if they were tossing the car keys to a child, Victoria Police wanted the world to look the other way while she swerved down the highway with an armed escort. They deliberately evaded the checks and balances of a system that serves to protect all from chicanery. The police and Gobbo appointed themselves as judge and jury, despite protections aimed at ensuring that no person or entity should ever wield absolute power. There were few officers who voiced concerns about the legal and ethical maelstrom of Nicola Gobbo. They are the only heroes in this tale of villainy, and the likes of Detectives Chris Lim, Charlie Bezina, and Ron Iddles, as well as Sir Ken Jones, merit praise for daring to tell the truth. Of course, Gobbo manipulated the police too. She decided what should be shared and who should be punished. When the police eventually jettisoned their weapon, the weapon took aim at them. This Iago did not submit, as did the Othello character, to torture and execution for her crimes. "I know our secret," Gobbo implied, "and if I have to, I will use my knowledge to destroy careers and reputations." Understandable, perhaps, given how she had suffered. Aspects of police behaviour are less so. Within Gobbo's first 15 months as informer 3838, Victoria police officers in the secretive loop of knowledge collectively came to believe she suffered psychiatric or psychological and personality dysfunction. She told her handlers in one discussion, "I'm a fucked up person, but you know that." Simon Overland told the Kellam Inquiry in 2014 that Gobbo had personality and attachment issues. She was pathologically incapable of acting in her own best interests. Yet Victoria Police kept her on as an informer for 3.5 years, when opening the letterbox or checking a text message might mean she was confronted by yet another death threat. The release was her deregistration so she could become a witness against Paul Dale in his Hodson murder trial. Yet her new circumstances, coupled with the burden of her old informer exploits, only condemned her to further risk. Her future was enveloped in her past. Her controller at the Source Development Unit, Sandy White, spoke of all high-risk sources in 2019 as not quite normal. This prompted a recommendation years after Gobbo was deregistered that any source exhibiting mental issues must be sent to a psychiatrist. White thought Gobbo was psychologically unstable. He described the informer program as a swamp of liars and nutjobs. "I have found that the very best human sources are those who have big egos because they try hard to get a successful result," he said. "There is no doubt in my mind that Miss Gobbo fell into that category." When White sent her to get professional help in 2006, the female psychologist did not think Gobbo was at risk of suicide or self-harm. She also said that Gobbo's personality problems were long-standing and not created by her role as a human source. Yet Gobbo was needy, as White called her years later. Her handlers had come to replace criminals as her social outlet. Testifying to the secret Ghanaian trial in 2016, Gobbo's long-term psychologist offered clues about the void in Gobbo's life. "So her father died when she was doing year 12, so she would have been 18, the psychologist said. "Her mother had had 2 bouts of cancer prior to that, and her father was quite a bit older than her mother. And there were 2 other children by the father's former marriage, so she has 2 half-siblings. And her father died, and that was relatively catastrophic for her. It was a very difficult event. And then her mother died in 2011 from pancreatic cancer, which is a very nasty condition." In the absence of a father figure, she sought to be validated by her handlers, and White in particular, who she later felt took advantage of her need to change the situation. "So one of the things we've worked on, and this is a common treatment with trauma, is to help her deconstruct, if you like, and speak about the matters that occurred some years ago in relation to her relationship with Victoria Police," the psychologist said in 2016. "And so we've spoken a lot about why she got involved with that and her sense of there being a void in her life, and that some of the people she got involved with at Victoria Police really fulfilled the father figure type of role. I think in that respect, she certainly would be a person vulnerable to that kind of experience." Gobbo told her psychologist she had spent thousands of hours with White and was very involved in doing activities in relation to her relationship with him. "I think she felt that he treated her as somebody special and valued her contributions to the work they were doing together," the psychologist said. Gobbo claimed she wanted to impress him, yet the relationship also made her feel trapped. That was a, yes, repetitive theme, Gobbo said in closed court in 2017. White gave me the impression that you could never earn their trust 100%, but I'd come close to that, yes. Gobbo had healthy relationships with her mother and at least one sibling, but limited family connections beyond that. Her gregariousness seemed to mask something even sadder. She didn't seem to want anyone too close. Even her beauty therapist, who gave Gobbo night appointments, felt her customer needed a friend. As her psychologist testified, Gobbo relied on her and an unnamed loved one for the kind of trust that others ordinarily share with partners and multiple loved ones. Yet Gobbo kept things from her counsellor, despite their many hours together, such as her odd desire to be the best informer in history. Her being is built on secrets and the keeping of them, and even those she trusted most were deprived of the fuller view. But Gobbo needed more than a shrink. The risks of her informing were not monitored as the police informer textbook demanded. The police would task her to get a phone number, say, or to chat with a crook about his criminal enterprises. Get license numbers, they said. Find links. They learned the pressure points of the criminals without leaving the office. A cynic might identify a pattern that went, please do the policing on behalf of Victoria Police, and if it's unclear to us what you're doing and how you're gathering the information, we accept that. You might be a bloody nightmare, as a very highly ranked officer has called her, but we bow to you as an untamable force of intelligence. Victoria Police also cocked their leg to history. They ignored the 1881 Longmore Royal Commission, set up following the outbreak of the Kelly Gang, and the Kelly Inquiries, 1932 to 1933, into Victorian police brutality. The founding tenets of British policing, the 1829 Peelian principles, didn't matter, including Principle 8, police should never appear to usurp the powers of the judiciary. Rather, they seem to have borrowed from the J. Edgar Hoover rulebook, which said that justice is merely incidental to law and order. The police kept one promise of the many they made to Gobbo. They vowed to hide her double life. When they couldn't, they built obstacles to the truth. But it seems Gobbo was not persuaded to inform by promises. She could see no other way. Whether driven by naivete or arrogance, she sought first of all to save herself. In choosing to inform, however, she sentenced herself to be never more than one misplaced whisper from death. Simon Overland admitted to the Callum inquiry that it was sometimes difficult to discern the exact circumstances in which Gobbo had come into possession of information, because of Gobbo's own blurred lines of professional conduct with respect to clients. She broke protocols aimed at preserving her well-being, yet no one tempered her excesses. Her license to thrill, bill, and spill was revoked only when Victoria Police found another use for her as a witness. Victoria Police can cite review after review of human source management. The organisation is a creaking bureaucracy, laden with protocols and procedures critical to policing in an unpredictable and changing world. Yet Victoria Police appear to have tossed out the rules of risk assessment with Gobbo from the start. Gobbo never received anything in writing about the terms of her informing. There was no legal advice, not in 1995 or 1999 or 2005 onwards. As former Chief Commissioner Neil Comrie wrote in his 2011 review, her informing career read like a case crying out for informed legal advice at the outset. Police did set out the risks to themselves. Gobbo needed to be corralled for the force's sake. Her second and final handler review in 2006 noted, because of the source's occupation and particular position, if compromised, the handling of this source would come under extreme scrutiny. This could cause embarrassment of the force. There is another way to put this. Victoria Police were seeking to cover their own behinds from the time they signed on Nicola Gobbo as their gangland secret weapon, despite their claims that they were protecting her. They knew the legal risks. Sandy White flew to England to research informer management before Gobbo was registered as 3838. But it appears that Victoria Police chose to ignore the international benchmarks. In November 2005, Gobbo told her handlers that her informing posed no ethical or legal issues. Such grandiose claims from someone who was, according to Comrie, clearly manic, went unquestioned. Her lifestyle was clearly unsustainable, Comrie wrote. Yet Gobbo's welfare seemed to be considered secondary to the welfare of the handlers who dealt with her. Instead of being concerned for her well-being, Victoria Police were drunk on the possibilities. Here was a spy who could put away the meanest of criminals. Here was a way to end the gangland war. One-time Piranha Head Detective Inspector Jim O'Brien claimed at the Royal Commission that he never turned his mind to Gobbo's possible breaching of legal professional privilege. The assumption appeared to be that such unconscionable breaches did not matter, again, so long as no one found out. Thousands of words of Victoria Police internal documents were couched in management jargon and shrouded in high secrecy. Their sheer volume gave the impression of thoroughness, but read in their entirety, they invite other conclusions. Victoria Police didn't care to assess the toxic overflow of Gobbo. The organisation was like a cheating husband who rationalises his deceit as a necessary part of his machismo. Victoria Police were as hooked on Gobbo as Gobbo was hooked on them. This underhanded approach has been defended in the context of bullets and safety, but the extraordinary times, extraordinary measures mantra doesn't seem to hold up. Gobbo's official registration in 2005 was a whole year after the spate of gangland killings. Carl Williams was locked up, and Tony Mockbell was about to be. Almost every other major player was dead or in prison. The criminal justice system is imperfect, as everyone who works within it has to accept. Grey areas leach into the black and white. But a lawyer who informs on her clients with the active encouragement of police is no grey area. That is why there are no known precedents for the systemised police use of a defence lawyer as an informer. Why didn't the FBI use a duplicitous lawyer to stem the mafia death toll? Or British intelligence agencies mandated to stop the IRA bombings? Why haven't books before now described lawyers dedicated to deceiving their criminal clients? Because, as the Comrie Review found, the notion is ethically repugnant. Convicted criminals are now lining up for get-out-of-jail cards and compensation payouts in the tens of millions of dollars, all because of a woman Victoria Police thought was crazy from the start. Victoria Police face more of the same critical judgments that they secretly concluded about themselves a long time ago. They have fought against the shame and possible criminality and are likely to continue doing so. By permitting Gobbo's informing, they blighted trust and decency, citing community safety as well as community pressure. But they also hobbled the pursuit of truth. The mantra of police homicide squads goes that everybody matters or no one matters. In their use of Gobbo, and in covering it up afterwards, Victoria Police place themselves on the wrong side of the equation. We do know that Gobbo's informing always had to end. She dodged the bullets and the bastards, but could not shake off the curiosity of a newspaper journalist. Observers, with the clarity of retrospect, can judge the outcomes as logical. Anthony Dalsley, or someone like him, was bound to come along, as was the Royal Commission that police fought so hard to avoid. Dalsley tapped Gobbo's secret when murderers and judges could not. The risk, as Dalsley often told himself in the unwanted wakefulness before dawn, was that Gobbo would lose everything. But the stain was not Dowsley's to apply. Gobbo's affront to ethics and honesty would come to define her, and there isn't much call for such skill sets outside the informing shadows. Once the gangland spy who changed the war, Gobbo is now condemned to the life of an average nobody. Like Henry Hill, anonymity has been foisted upon her. Gobbo dosed up on so much adrenaline that she is now severely depressed and largely unresponsive to treatments, like a wind-up toy wound too many times. She has attempted to adjust to her loss of power and reputation. She has tried a personal trainer to dim the depression. She has had to find new meaning in the absence of her secret life. But it has been hard. She spoke to Mick Gatto after Dowsley's 2014 Lawyer X expose, and oddly, Rob Karam, the drug baron fighting 37 years in jail because of her deception. She spoke to others too, some very dangerous, knowing they were people who will kill you if they find out who you really are. Was she trying to dim the fear of always looking over her shoulder? Or was she clinging to the only identity she knew? Gobbo still wants to work. The law is gone, along with her professional reputation. Speaking to a police handler, she once voiced whims of being an air traffic controller or FBI profiler. She even proposed becoming a talent scout for Victoria Police Informers. All these roles would have played to her strengths. Yet Gobbo spoke of another prospect. She didn't seem like someone who would bathe private parts or swap bedpans, but she expressed an interest to her psychologist in becoming a nurse. The psychologist, a mother figure, did not point out that the ethical demands of nursing are just as life and death as those of her lawyer past. She believed that nursing could offer Gobbo an identity that wasn't around infamy. On the stand in 2016, the psychologist spoke of Gobbo's need to find other things she can do with herself that actually give her some purpose. This is a challenge for someone who has always felt empty. Gobbo has never tried normal before. As the psychologist said, Gobbo didn't know if she could relinquish her identity and still be who she is. Hill moved again and again, with his wife and children, in a twilight existence where being himself would have been fatal. Gobbo faces a similar erasure of her history. Perhaps she will chase the sun, as she always has. The price of her chaos seems destined to be her greatest fear, abandonment. Everyone she has known has burned her, or been burned by her. She is, as a former colleague has said, radioactive. In Exposure, she is like Hill, or Donnie Brasco, the FBI undercover agent credited with 100 mafia convictions. She is alone and vulnerable, a nocturnal animal doomed to eternal sunshine. Disarmed of righteousness and her unofficial police cloak, the scorpion has lost her sting and skitters for release. She has ample legal, health, and welfare excuses for seeking refuge in dark places. She thrilled to her informing with the same zeal as Terry Hodson. He felt like a dead man walking in his final months in 2004, and now Gobbo cowers under the same cloud of doom. The drama of her double life always offered far more than the ordinariness of a mum who blends into the crowd. This is what Gobbo can now look forward to if she can avoid grimmer fates. Charges await, potentially, along with the ongoing humiliation that comes with the public judgment of your deceptions and mental struggles. Nicola Gobbo stands as a case study in the abuse of power. Her exposure may lead to criminal convictions for the law keepers and freedom for the law breakers. Yet her legacy will be something more. Nicola Gobbo broke the system, and she almost got away with it. How will she pay? With a lifetime sentence of hiding in plain sight.